Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Previously on the Mike Wise Show.
He's very sensitive, like all probably tall people are. And he's and I could still see it sometimes when Charles needles him and it goes too far. You could see Shaquille like almost fuming, like, "I'm going to slap this guy right now." Do you ever see that?
I do. I see it. And I remind him, you know, just play nice. I tease them both. Because Charles' mother and I were very good friends. And we send them notes. Okay, you be good. You know, just teasing them. But that's the human side of him. And sometimes people say hurtful things. And they don't mean to be hurtful. But the way that it comes out, it hurts his feelings sometimes.
The big man with feeling. J.A. Adande is today's guest. He is a man of many talents, writing, television, radio, and now academia. All right, Darlene, take it away.
The Mike Wise Show is a presentation of Pure Hoops Media. The Mike Wise Show is hosted by a guy who played basketball atrociously for Hawaii Pacific College, which forced him into journalism. And, oh yeah, he wrote about basketball for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and ESPN. He's also a wise ass, and so are many of his guests. Right, Mike?
Welcome to the Mike Wise Show. I am so excited to welcome J.A. Adande to the program, a guy who's been more than just a colleague of mine. He's probably been a friend. I call him that. I've been a guest. A proud guest of his in the Medill School of Journalism, where he's the sports journalism. You're head of the department, right, at Northwestern, Jay?
Not quite, but director of sports journalism. I don't have anybody working in under me, so I guess I don't have a department. But
you have you have assistants or interns, don't you?
No, I mean, I have colleagues, but I really don't have anybody working under me.
Okay, just fake it. Just say you're like you're. J.A. Adande, as most of you know, worked for a decade at ESPN. I got to know him a little bit when he was a columnist for the LA Times, Los Angeles Times. It was kind of his first.
We go back to my Washington Post days, though.
Oh, I take that back. Yeah, because when was your first year
in New York?
Post?
I was at the Post from 94 to 97, so that was your Knicks coverage days, right?
This is correct. And I had just left the Sacramento Union, gotten a great job at the New York Times, and we probably saw each other at least 10 times a year just covering the Bulls and seeing the Bulls in the title games and the Knicks. And that's right. One of my favorite memories, by the way, Jay Adande, before we get into the news of the day and the NBA and whatnot, is I remember going to Portland one year and Frank Isola of the New York Daily News, I think it was some playoff game for something, and he said to me, "Hey, look, you can get some Nike discounts at this Beaverton store, and it's the employee store, but they give riders discounts." I'm like, "Really?" And all of a sudden, I guess a lot of riders were at the either the Western Conference Finals or whatever that year. Adande and I think it was Michael Wilbon rented a van and basically packed it up with sports writers, and they cleaned up. Like, they walked in there like
the
athletes.
That was from Seattle during the finals. Yeah, that was the 96 Bulls. Sonic
That's right, 96
finals.
Bulls.
So the funniest thing, so there were two off days between like game 3 and 4, I think. We're out there in Seattle, and you know, Bulls were up like 3-0, so it's really no news. So we go on the first day of the press conferences, and so we wrote one story, and then we got up early the next day and filed our stories, and we were going to skip out, play hooky on the media availability, because what were they going to say? Nothing had changed, you know, between
the
previous day
sweep.
And that day, right?
You know, the
there was no
sweep.
News, right? We all thought the Bulls were going to sweep. So our editors got a little suspicious because we filed our stories at like 9 a.m. Eastern time, 6 o'clock Pacific. You know, right. Like, what are these guys up to? And yeah, we hopped in the van and drove down, I guess it's like 2.5 hours or something down the coast to Beaverton and hit up the employee store and did damage. That was my second time going. I went after the Final Four the year before.
No, this was incredible. This was sort of really pre-big internet. Maybe the cell phones were pretty big at the time. And I just remember people calling from the aisles and basically saying, John, what do you want for your birthday? Cole Haans? Okay, don't worry. We got it. And it was like, we were the athletes for one day. I look at it in hindsight and I go, oh my gosh, like we broke every rule of etiquette and professionalism, a conflict of interest. Do you look at it now that you're basically director of sports journalism at Northwestern and think to yourself, oh, you know, how can I tell my students not to take a freebie now and then when we got these incredible discounts?
But it wasn't free. It wasn't free.
We were paying $50 for like $300 shoes.
You got the NCAA mentality where they're like, oh, you can't have special benefits. Like, there's a difference between getting free stuff and having special benefits, right? Like, if you're going to turn down the Nike employee store discounts, then what, were you not going to sit courtside with the seats that they gave you with your press pass back then when we were sitting courtside? So, you know, there's a difference between special benefits and free stuff.
No, I don't think we, as swag goes, we didn't go out on a limb, but I'm telling you that was, I think I did Christmas shopping there that year. And I thought, how am I going to kill Phil Knight in a column, how he's corrupting our young men with this stuff. So Jay Adande is my guest. He's covered the NBA. He's written about almost everything. He worked for the Washington Post, the LA Times, ESPN for 10 years. I, for anybody out there that's sort of, because we're in such a weird time in our profession, and so many people that you and I either grew up reading or know about, all of a sudden are either working for a team writing on their website, or, and we don't even call them sellouts anymore. We're just happy they have jobs, or they just had to completely switch careers. I know you weren't forced out of journalism, but you went into teaching because you wanted to. It was a better lifestyle, and it was something very important to you because you went to Northwestern yourself. If you had to give a quick synopsis of, or some advice for anybody that's sort of thinking about leaving an industry that is so topsy-turvy right now and trying to recreate themselves in the next thing, what would you say?
Wow. We kind of have to build up to it. You know, this wasn't a sudden thing. I'd been teaching as an adjunct professor at USC for 12 years. So I built up a little credibility in this space. So I think that helps. In particular, in the world of academia, to not have advanced degrees, postgraduate degrees can be a hindrance. This was the one case where it wasn't going to hurt me because all I had was a bachelor's, but my bachelor's is from Northwestern. So my argument was going to be that if this isn't good enough, what are you saying about our program here? That my bachelor's degree isn't good enough for me to get a job at Northwestern. So, but it helps to think ahead. And, you know, maybe you should always be thinking about your next move even before you've made your first move. And some of my students who were undergraduate journalism students were talking to me about, you know, should I get a master's? And we have an accelerated master's program at Medill where you can get 2 degrees in 4.5 years, basically, if you get on the program right away. And so they were saying, you know, I think I kind of want to get my master's. And I don't necessarily think you need a master's in journalism if you have a bachelor's in journalism. You know, I don't know how much
you're going to learn. Do not say that. We are here to pump your grad school program.
If
you're
going to
get one, get one from
Columbia
or Northwestern.
If you don't have undergraduate experience, but you know, I don't. It's a little redundant to get both. But as some of my students said, well, you know, if I want to teach one day, this would make it easier to get a job at university. And that is absolutely the case. So, you know, if you're thinking, okay, so you might want to get a master's in journalism, not necessarily to help you out in your journalism career, mm-hmm. but to help you out in your post-journalism career.
What do you tell people? What do you tell your students when they say, how am I going to get a job? And what do I do to get a job? Because what we learned as classically trained journalists, where we went to school and what we did and paying our dues at different places, there's none of that anymore. There's sort of this, you know, what I call the MSJ world, the multi-skilled journalist, where if you're not blogging or taking videos with your iPhone and putting something together and then creating a Facebook Live, in addition to your story and everything else, you're not doing your job. It's such a different business. What do you tell them?
All those components that you talked about are absolutely a part of it today, but it's also a benefit. The biggest hindrance to getting into the business when we were coming up was either getting published or getting on the air, right? And now, yeah, anyone with a cell phone, you can publish yourself or you can broadcast yourself. So those barriers are gone. You know, examples of what you can do and having other people see what you can do, there's no barrier to that. Getting paid to do so is a little more difficult. And the path, the standard path where you'd start off at a smaller newspaper and covering high schools and work your way up to colleges, maybe cover the pros there, or go to a bigger paper and cover colleges and then cover the pros, and have the opportunity to travel and cover a multitude of events, that path doesn't really exist anymore, at least not in the normal regard. But there's so many other entries and there's so many different jobs now. So there, yeah, are those jobs that you alluded to, working for teams that didn't exist before, working for leagues. You can be a play-by-play person calling play-by-play of a video game, you know, in the NBA 2K league, and, right, and covering that.
That's a job. Or shoot, that,
yes,
you know, how many
can be a job of a, or playing a video game or doing play-by-play of a video game, you know, in these live contests that they're having. So
that's crazy.
There's a lot of opportunities out there. And one thing I'm finding too is you might just have to be a little more patient. I don't think it's all doom and gloom, but you might not step out right away and step into a job and have a job waiting for you. But if you give it a year, I'm finding with a lot of my graduates that we've had, both undergraduate and the graduate program, you know, it might take a year to sort of settle down and sort, yeah, things out. But there's stuff out there. There are jobs out there. There's social media positions that didn't exist 10 years ago. Every team has a social media department now and digital video department. So you're right, not as many independent jobs, but there are jobs where you can use your reporting and your storytelling skills, get paid to do so, and work in the field of sports.
How old were you when you got the job at the LA Times as a columnist?
I look back now and it seems absurd. I was 26 years old.
Oh, I mean, you were like in the, what year was that, 94?
That was 96.
97,
I'm sorry, 1997.
1997, right. You went from the Chicago Sun-Times to there, or the Post? You were
no,
the Post.
From the Post. Yes,
that's
I've
right.
been the Post for 3 years. So I worked at the Sun-Times for 2 years, and my boss there, Rick Jaffe, he had stopped at the LA Times as he was working his way up the ladder. He made it to the National when the National folded. Rest in peace. He went to the Chicago Sun-Times and was a sports editor there, and he hired me there. And we used to talk. He knew I was from LA, and we'd sort of talk whimsically almost. He'd say, you know, if I ever get back out to LA, I'm going to bring you back out there with me. And a year later, I went to the Washington Post. And then a year after that, he went out to the LA Times. And, you know, we kind of forged the connection. And
yep.
I said, okay, let me know when you have an opportunity. And in 97, the opportunity arose. And he brought me, stayed true to his word and brought me out there and brought me home. And that was probably the only place I would have left the Washington Post for. I really liked the Washington Post.
Yeah.
You know, loved working at that first class news organization, and but the chance to go home and to write a sports column for the newspaper I grew up reading, having delivered to my doorstep, I couldn't pass that up.
Yeah, and I bring all that up because that at the time, 26 years old, I can't stress to our younger listeners, but also everybody out there, you get a columnist job at the LA Times. At that time, the columnists of the LA Times included Jim Murray. Mike Downey, Scott Osler. The names were, and people don't remember these guys now because they've sort of become almost mom and pop shops next to all the big Gaps and Banana Republic franchises out there that we've worked for, by the way. But the bottom line was that was a big deal at the time. And now it's me too. Like if you told me I was going to work 10 years at the New York Times and another 10 at the Washington Post and then leave either of those places, I mean, that was the dream job. Nowadays, the dream job can be three different things. I mean, it's such a weird world. I
couldn't believe I, you know, signing to leave the LA Times. I had to work up the nerve to do it. You know, I knew, and I couldn't say it at the time, but I knew I had something lined up at ESPN as a matter of finalizing everything and making it formal. But, you know, so I knew I had a great opportunity waiting, but I still couldn't believe I was getting ready to hand in my resignation to the LA Times. I had to look myself in the bathroom mirror and sort of steel myself up to it. And what I thought was really amazing was a few years later, when Howard Beck left the New York Times to go to Bleacher Report. And at one point that would have been unfathomable, you know, before we knew what a Bleacher Report was. And then in the early stages of Bleacher Report, when it was just kind of slideshows and clickbait and stuff like that, to think of leaving the New York Times for that. But by the time Howard Beck left the Times for Bleacher Report, it made perfect sense, right? It wasn't even that much of a wow. You said,
I feel like newspapers were king probably last king around 2002 or something. 2002, and then all of a sudden if it wasn't ESPN.com or the Huffington Post or all these incredible sites that capitalized on the fact that we gave away our content for free, the bottom line is that the prominence of them died and people took different jobs. I could talk about this all day, but you came along at a time when and everybody's either fortuitous or unlucky with some of the teams they get to cover in the towns they're at. And it dictates their career sometimes because of their Q rating. Sometimes some of the best writers are stuck in these small places or places that just never win. And you never hear about. You covered the Chicago Bulls during their heyday. And I'm talking to a guy, Jay Adondi, who's now, I think, 48 years old, 20 years after these incredible Bulls teams and being part of that, you go up to game two of Bucks Raptors in the Eastern Conference Finals. And when you see the Bucks play and they win a team that wins 60 games like that, are there any similarities to Michael's Bulls, or do you think it's just a different era and we appreciate different things?
Well, for one thing, it's interesting. They don't have that second Hall of Famer on the team. You know, I think Giannis is on that track to go to the Hall of Fame. But
you're totally disrespecting Ilyasova.
But the Bulls have had at least two with Michael and Scottie the whole time. And, you know, the kind of the standard for years was you had to have at least two Hall of Famers. You know, lately it's been more like three or four even. But I see this team.
So is Giannis Antetokounmpo that good?
It's that they're that deep. And that's what the takeaway from a lot of people there was. And it's interesting. I've never seen so many people be converted and become believers in a team so late. You know, we're midway through the conference finals, and a lot of that people in the building, their takeaway was this team could do it. They could beat the Warriors with or without Durant, especially if the Warriors don't get Durant back. And it's just strange to see a buy-in on a team this late. Here we are mid-May, and people are starting to believe in the Milwaukee Bucks. And part of it was probably, you know, they hadn't really seen the Bucks. And I doubt many people have seen him in person in the playoffs until this conference finals. And so now they get a look at him. Game one, the Raptors probably should have won. But game two, the Bucks just thoroughly dominated and took control of the series. And you saw everything that made them great. And you felt it. Just being in the locker room, the camaraderie that they have, the belief in each other, the ease with which they're playing, the confidence that they have. I'm not sure all of that would translate into the NBA Finals, just because I try to tell people the Finals are such a completely different beast where you don't even recognize your own arena. You come in there and there's all these decals.
That's a great point.
And you know, there's, you know, curtains hanging all over the place, and you have to take a different path from your car to the locker room because there's so much stuff in the way, and you can't even recognize your own arena.
Well, And the arena itself on media days is all of a sudden you go from, you know, a little three guys around you in the locker room to 82 people at a podium on your own home court. And some of the questions are thoughtful and some of them are annoying. Some of them are humorous. But the bottom line is, you know, you're right. You can't prepare for the madness that is the finals until you're actually there.
And that's why I say, a new team in the finals going up against a team that's been there before, like that's one loss right there. I think that counts for one loss. And then it's a matter of whether or not they can compensate and how quickly they can get up to speed. I always say that Oklahoma City team that went up against the Heat in 2012, And people on the Thunder organization were telling me that, okay, the moment's just too big for them. And they thought they'd be back. I'll never forget that image. I don't know. Did you cover that finals?
Yes. And it was,
remember
it was
that?
I think I was sort of rooting for OKC early on, too, in the finals, because the place was so loud. It felt like Sacramento did in the early 2000s when Weber and Bibby were, like, giving the Lakers all they could handle. And you've had this small market.
It felt like the start of something, right?
Yeah, It felt like, wow, this could be around for a while.
Even when they were losing, so there was this moment, they take all the stars out of the game. They're losing game five. They're going to lose the series. The season's over. And Westbrook, Durant, and Harden were all standing on the baseline by the bench. They weren't sitting down. They're all standing next to each other. And I took a picture with one of my earlier cell phone cameras, so it's not the greatest picture, but I do have it somewhere in my files. And you're looking at those three and thinking, okay, this is going to be the trio that's going to be here in June. They're going to be a fixture in the NBA Finals. And then they never played a game together as a trio. You know, Harden was gone. And then of course, Durant came a couple years later. And it's crazy to think all three of those guys won MVP awards, but they never played another game together after that one. So that's why you have to be careful anointing teams of the future. And some people are already starting to do that with the Milwaukee Bucks, and they're going to be around a long time. You just don't know what's going to happen, especially in this day and age when the player movement is so fast and furious. And, you know, the contracts are shorter. The owners partly have themselves to blame for this roster churn that we have now, because they didn't want to be on the hook for 7-year contracts when guys were getting up there in their late 30s and were still pulling, you know, probably at the time, $20, $25 million a year.
Yeah, they don't want the Gilbert Arenas deal where they had to, became like your lemon for my lemon. You're right. And they completely, the idea that sort of they wanted to fix parity that way. Well, no, actually, you even heard it more in some ways, because it's much easier to, like when I used to say when we play pickup ball, like if you want to play with your friends and keep the court for a while, much easier to do that in the NBA now because of those contracts. The Mike Wise Show with me, Mike Wise, comes your way each Monday with great guests like Jeannie Buss, Jamal Crawford, Jason Whitlock of Fox Sports, and this week's guest, J.A. Adonde. We also have three other weekly shows from Pure Hoops Media. Each Wednesday, Noah Kozloff and Adam Stanko come your way with Catch and Shoot, where they mix great hoop discussion with humor and some great guests. Each Thursday, it's our newest show, Buckets, Boards, and Blocks, with Monica McNutt and her cast of characters. And every Friday, yes, the Pure Hoops podcast with my friends BJ Armstrong and Eric Newman. Please check all of them out. Listen, download, rate, review, subscribe, and enjoy. My guest is J.A. Adonde. He is the director of sports journalism at Northwestern University, a 10-year vet at ESPN, Washington Post, Chicago Sun-Times, L.A. Times. He's run the gamut of all the big media institutions in America. And now he's teaching kids, besides other things. When I think about Giannis Antetokounmpo, and you said that there wasn't a buy-in on the Bucks early on. I think part of it was LeBron was out of the conference for the first time in 8 years, for the first time in his career, and for the first in the last 8 years, whatever team he was on went to the finals, and so I thought it was a tremendous opportunity for about four or five different teams to leap through the hoop and say, we can take his throne. We can be the team. And I thought for a while, before John Wall got hurt and the Wizards floundered and fell apart, I thought the Celtics, the Sixers, the Raptors.
What point did you think the Wizards? Seriously.
Wait.
Two years ago.
They were a few possessions from beating the Celtics in a game seven.
You're right.
And that would be their first Eastern Conference Finals since whatever, the Wes Unseld days. And so I'm not saying that they were going to win an NBA Finals with the West. I'm not saying that they would have beat LeBron James. But I thought that with that roster and with a couple upgrades, they had a shot. Now, I live in D.C. As you know, I'm probably a worse homer than half the fans here. And maybe that was a little being unrealistic, but I thought they had something. And I look now at like Philadelphia. I knew that Philadelphia was going to be angry. Boston should be really angry because they had a shot. And whoever was going to lose in the second round could go home and think to themselves, God, we had a shot. I'm not so sure that you can feel that after if this Eastern Conference Finals goes five games. I mean, I think the Bucks are for real for the next 3 years.
Yeah, but like I said, we thought the Thunder would be there. You know, the Bucks are going to have some free agency issues to address. You know, Giannis. The cool thing is, it feels like Giannis wants to be there long term. You know, like Giannis is, and he doesn't even really necessarily want to recruit free agents. You know, he just wants to be there, and anybody wants to join him, have at it. But you know, this is his team, and this is going to be his city. You get that same feeling out of Damian Lillard. You know, they might not have the potential and the upside that the Bucks have, but it's been pretty cool seeing him, you know, really establish himself in these playoffs. And you also get the feeling that he's not itching to go somewhere else and to team up with some other guys. It looks bright for the Bucks. They've got a beautiful new building, which should help the revenues and help them stay competitive on that front. You know, the other thing is the small market notion isn't what it was, because some of these guys are so rich that own these small market teams, you know, including the Bucks ownership group, that, you know, it's not strictly a matter of what type of revenue can they generate with that team in that market. These guys have so much money, you know, from their outside businesses that they can choose to pour as much as they want into this team in order to do what it takes to make them competitive.
Yeah. All of that is true. And you wonder what the future of the Bucks is going to be. I think it's great. I think, you know, I think that the idea that sort of, I don't know, they'd be San Antonio North for a few years if they could actually pull it off. And they hadn't been that, I guess, they hadn't been that relevant since, I have to go back to Michael Redd and Ray Allen and that team. And then before that, Don Nelson's teams. So
yeah,
the early
80s. They haven't had a player like Giannis. Like every big number he puts up, like when he goes for 30 and 15, whatever, the only name in the record book is Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Giannis is probably he's so dynamic. He's such a different big man. I don't even know who to compare him to. Who would you compare him to?
There's nothing like him. And he's so unique and he's so gifted athletically and just the physical specimen. So before the game the other night, he was, you know, just on the court getting some warm-up shots in, and there are all these TV cameras lined up and tripods and reporters doing their live shots before the game. And there were people on the court working out with Giannis and coaches helping him and rebounding for him. And he just stood above all of it. And he was like a good foot and a half taller than all the equipment and the people. And he just looks like he's on a different plane. You know, he's someone operating just on a completely different plane and level than everyone else. So you start from that. And then, so it's interesting. So somebody said, well, Shaq is big, but Shaq was there at the game, of course, working for TNT. And I walked out of the arena with him, and Shaq is just so completely different. Shaq is just massive, and just the space that he occupies and his ability to physically overpower. And I know, you know Shaq well and worked with him. Sure. But Giannis is different in that he changes the landscape and the geometry and his ability to cover ground, you know, his ability to get places to get from the 3-point line to the basket with one dribble because of those giant strides, or his ability to you know, clog the middle and then still get out and contest a 3-point shot. So with Giannis, it's more of the landscape and the spacing of the courts, as opposed to Shaq, just the physical power.
That's a great distinction. He really broke it down because Giannis has such an economy of movement. Like, it's as if, you know, Tim Duncan were all of a sudden, you know, had a 48-inch vertical or something.
And it's the same height. Well, and that's the crazy thing, too, is like Kevin Durant with Duncan. So there was a great picture. Yeah. And LeBron, too. So I think of these still photos. So LeBron in that 2007 finals, when he goes to the finals for the first time and they get swept by the Spurs, and they cross paths like in the hallway on the way to and from the interview room. And you realize LeBron is basically the same height as Tim Duncan. And then same thing with Kevin Durant in what turned out to be Duncan's last game in the playoffs. You know, you see them talking and you realize Kevin Durant is Tim Duncan's height, but plays a completely different game without shooting 3-pointers. And
Giannis
you know,
is seven. Is he seven? Is he a real?
Over.
Giannis is a real 7'1" or 7'2", right?
I'd say tops out at 7 or just under 7.
Okay.
You know, just like Durant is probably 7. We like to say 6'11". You know, I wouldn't say they go over that, but their arms are so long. But it's weird because they, you know, they play in such a different part of the court than Tim Duncan occupied and Shaq occupied, even though, you know, they have similar heights, especially Duncan. Duncan, again, Shaq is just such a unique physical specimen. But, you know, to see these guys who are basically eye to eye with Tim Duncan, and yet they play completely different games. Their ball handling ability, even more so than when Magic was 6'9" handling the ball. These guys are 6'11", 7 feet handling the ball like a guard.
Yeah. And even the Joker, man.
Evolution of the game.
I mean, like Jokic, man, he just has a nose for passing, you know, and hitting guys not just that open, but on their fingertips as they're cutting, as if he's a point guard. I'm like, well, this guy's just – He's, you know, I don't know, he's 24 in real life, and he's 55. He's got the 55 soul of an old
guy. He
moves
like a 55-year-old.
He
makes basketball look really hard and really easy all at once, right? Because, like, the way he moves, you're like, God, it's like he's laboring out there. But then the way he just has this soft touch and the way he finds everybody, you're like, man, he makes basketball look really
simple. And also, like, because we get to know some of these guys outside of the game a little bit, as much as you can peripherally, unless you go out to eat with them, whatever. They just seem like Giannis and guys like the Joker and Steph and other guys, some of the most down-to-earth, I always said that there was a part of the NBA that there would always be 12 guys that you just – gave the game a bad name, and I don't know who it was at whatever time, but these guys, like, all they do is give the game a good name. They're just regular people.
And it's funny, even the bad guy, like Ron Artest, was public enemy number one at one point for the NBA, right? But, you know, even he became beloved.
No, he's such a redemptive quality, though.
Right.
I mean, it's sort of like he ends up going, shoot, the guy. I was in D.C. He went to Capitol Hill and basically talked to senators about mental health and how teams had not told him not to take his medication because they cut off his edge at some point. I mean, he's just like – the guy was real courageous. He talked about his mental health issues, and I thought, man, this –
Yeah, how can you not root for that guy?
And all
it's
that,
weird.
Yeah.
And the villains are like, okay, we were mad at LeBron because he went on TV to announce his free agency. we were mad at Kevin Durant because he chose to go from Oklahoma City to the Bay Area.
Well, he
and,
also had
you know,
five
play
burner
on a good
accounts.
Team. Like, are those that reason to be upset at people? You know,
no.
Both LeBron and Durant, like they haven't had a whiff of trouble, right? Like,
no.
I think LeBron might have had a moving violation in his car, like when he was in high school. That's the closest any type of police involvement he's had, you know. And Durant, you know, has been very clean, no trouble with the law or anything like that. And so we get mad at these guys just because they exercise their right to free agency, you know. But it shows you that, you know, the league is in a good place and that we almost have to manufacture the bad guys. And I do think you need bad guys. And I think you need characters and heroes and villains and conflict and drama, all that. It makes it more compelling. And one thing we're losing, too, is rivalries, you know. So, with the teams change. So, obviously, Golden State and Cleveland was the modern-day Lakers and the Celtics, right? But always meeting in the finals. But that's over because LeBron left. So, we only had 4 years of that rather than a decade of that like we did in the 60s.
Yeah, I know. You speak the truth on all this. Jay Adani is my guest. He's thoughtful on many issues. I want to go just to play with this a little bit before we knock it off. And it's because you've written very thoughtfully and with a lot of conviction on many issues near and dear to my heart, including what I call the renaissance of social conscience among athletes. I don't want to say I remember Larry Bird and Billy Hunter almost at the same time had quotes saying the league needs another American born white superstar to really take off. And it's not because it's racist. It's just because people want to see people that look like them and are from their area, the season ticket buyers. And I'm not saying that every NBA star has crossed over to not a black guy, just a ball player. But I do feel like, they're the greatest whatever white star I can think of that's from America now. I mean, J.J. Redick, Kevin Love, maybe Gordon Hayward. I mean, I don't think – and those guys aren't even, like, in the top 15 players. So I guess what I'm getting at is, do we even need – have we gone – I'm not saying the that anything in America is post-racial. That's the worst term of all. But are we past the notion that we need an American-born white superstar for the NBA to thrive the way it did in the Bird Magic Michael days? I think we bought into these guys so much that it doesn't matter.
I think Larry Bird's greatest legacy is that we don't need another Larry Bird right now. We absolutely needed good. Him in the 1980s. Absolutely. It's funny. People say Magic, and I bought into that too, and I came up with that, and you know, I was raised on that Lakers-Celtics rivalry and Magic and Bird, and it was always Magic and Bird, Magic and Bird. And really, the more I think about it, you needed Bird, right? If it was Magic versus Jordan, I don't think you would have had the success that the NBA enjoyed in the 80s and the foundation that was laid for today if it had been two African-American players. But the fact that Larry Bird was white, American-born, was, you know, multiple MVP and a champion, the league needed that at that time. And I think basketball fans have evolved past that. The league will be fine without another Larry Bird coming around. I think it could go to new heights. It could go up a level, I think, if we were to have another one. But the very existence of the league, which maybe the existence wasn't threatened, but it was certainly on the ropes before they got there. Remember, the games were on tape delay, right? The NBA Finals were being shown at 10:30 p.m. on tape delay. And you wouldn't have had this boom that you've had. And I think we've gotten to the point now where, you know, like a Jokic can be embraced. Look at Dirk Nowitzki's popularity in Dallas. And how many athletes in Dallas do you think are more popular than Dirk Nowitzki right now, even though he's born in Germany? But he's one of them. So, like, on two fronts, the progress that we've made in terms of African-Americans and the acceptance of European-born and foreign-born players.
You know,
Manu Ginobili was super popular in San Antonio and around the league. So on both of those fronts, the league doesn't need it. Now, I think it would help. You know, it would really be beneficial. Ask any TV executive, and I'm sure they would love to market the current Larry Bird right now. That would help. It's interesting. There's still some changes, and this might be baseball, or this might be the Chicago White Sox in particular. A friend of mine was just in town, and he went down to the White Sox game, and he wanted to get a Tim Anderson jersey. Tim Anderson's the only African-American player on the current White Sox roster, and just like a jersey shirt, right? And they didn't have any in the store. Like, they had to go to the storage and get it, and they got one to him later. Like, they literally had to call him and bring it to his seat where he was sitting at the stadium. But I thought that was telling.
You couldn't walk
into the White Sox team store. And, you know, you still see it. Like, I remember going to the New York Jets game years ago.
It's an indictment on how, you know, the game of Jackie Robinson has just fallen so short in the African-American community. And not even that, and that in particular, but also in general. There's just a lot of kids that, they might play baseball when they're younger, but they don't stick with it because, you know, I think some of it's society. We're all about immediate gratification. It's why soccer will never top basketball or football here, because, you know, while other people see this great strategy and these long setups and attacks before a goal, in our country, we want immediate gratification. You know, nobody wants to have a conversation at a game that lasts 20 minutes between innings because that's not who we are anymore as a society. And it's too bad in many ways. I hate to sound like, you know, get off my lawn guy, but I think it's sad.
But I think, again, the progress, and this might be unique to the NBA. So I think to be an NBA fan is, you know, for white fans of the NBA, they've moved past the point of, okay, I need a white guy to root for, right? If you're gonna enjoy the NBA, if you're gonna be a season ticket holder, if you're gonna watch the games, you basically are starting from the pretense that, you know, most of the players on my team are gonna be African American. And I noticed it at the but they don't feel the need to go out of their way. So at the Bucks game, you're gonna see guys wearing Antetokounmpo jerseys, you know, tons of them. White people wearing Antetokounmpo jerseys, or throwback Ray Allen jerseys. Like, you don't see people hunting out Pat Connaughton jerseys, you know, like, oh, you know, I want to represent the Bucks, but, you know, it's got to be white guys, so let me rock a Connaughton. I don't think I saw a single Pat Connaughton jersey. It's not like that in the NFL or in Major League Baseball, you know, but yeah. NBA fans, you know, that subset of America, and, you know, don't be fooled in thinking that the NBA is taking over, is bigger than NFL, none of that. But the subset of America that's into the NBA, they are perfectly willing to, you know, to just look past race and focus on who are the players that I enjoy, regardless of their race.
Yeah. And you just crystallize why I like the league so much and why I have such a problem with the NFL and what it's become. And even the Super Bowl, I thought it was almost insulting the way in which they sort of wanted to take the baton of social elixir. And okay, great. John Lewis got a ticket to the Super Bowl and he got to be there and he should have been recognized. But you know what? He probably should have been recognized 10 years ago at a Super Bowl. And exactly. Oh, the whole thing. Yeah, it was just for it was. Yeah, it was sort of like, look at us. We pay attention to inner city issues now. And yet, no, you pay attention to them because these guys threatened your market share, and they got some like union workers. They got some concessions finally from you because you're so awful as people. And you finally looked at it as, okay, we need to appease some of the people who have convictions beyond football in our league, and we can't just call them all SOBs like the president. I just think it's funny how Trump has become this lightning rod, and the Warriors and other teams that, you know, visit the White House, it's such a litmus test of who you are in America. And that, you know, everybody says, well, I just want to see The Office. But still, if you win, I can't tell you how many people in my newsroom that I'm working at now in D.C., WSA9, African-American employees are like, oh, man, Tiger messed up. Tiger went all in guy said Tiger went all in with Cheeto Jesus. I don't know what he's thinking.
And then I just thought it was funny. I'm like,
and he missed the cut. Yeah, it's karma. Get the Congressional Medal of Freedom. All right. One or two more lightning round with J.A. Donde. He's been great, giving us some extra time. He's the director of sports journalism at Northwestern University. He's also my friend, and he's a great journalist. Jay, really quick, I had Ryan McDonough on here not too long ago, the former Phoenix Suns GM. Now he's all over the radio since he's done our podcast. I don't want to say that your career is going to blow up after this because it already has been there, but I'm just telling you. I read these Wikipedia things sometimes and I go, this is BS. This is bullshit. But I read this thing and it's suddenly, you know, like Will McDonough, his dad, was tight with Whitey Bulger, the gangster, for a while. And I was like, and he gives us this great story of the whole thing. And I was like, it was just tremendous. And like how he visited him in Kansas, and I was like, wow. And he goes, yeah, I got to play it down a little bit. You know, it happened.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was nuts. But I read this about you. It says that you were the son of, is it Desiree, Desire and Elizabeth Oberstein Adonde? Yeah, Desiree and Elizabeth Adonde. Your grandfather, Gerson Gus Oberstein. What's that?
My mom never took my father's last name. Overstein. Yeah, then my grandfather was Gus Oberstein.
Gus Oberstein was a violinist who also played with Jasmine, Joe Roland, and Charlie Parker, the Bird, and later with the Berkeley Symphony. Is that all true? That's crazy.
Yeah, that part, if you got that off the Wikipedia, that part's true. The part they once had where they said I was romantically involved with Halle Berry, that part is not true. I actually had to go in and erase that myself. So she wouldn't sue me for libel.
Why would you erase
anything.
That?
I know. I believe in accuracy. I believe in accuracy. As much as I would like to have that out there,
but you could be
not true.
That's the kind of thing. That's the kind of thing Rihanna would see. And she would just be like, oh my gosh, you went out with Holly. I guess he'd go out with
guy.
Me.
But the part of my grandfather, and he actually
that's great.
Sinatra for a while. There's a famous story. My mom and my grandfather at the airport one time in San Francisco, he was picking her up. He flew into San Francisco where they lived, and they passed by Sinatra, and you know, my grandfather had played with him way back when, and says, "Hi, Frank," and Sinatra pauses, says, hold the phone. I know you. And it didn't hit him at first, but then my grandfather had to explain.
That's true. Oh, man, that's tremendous. And Oberstein, the Jewish name. So you half black, have like, what would be your ethnicity, or do you even identify? Does it even matter?
I mean, if you, and I won't do a 23andMe because I'm not trying to have, as other people have access to all my DNA and all that. So I don't believe in all that stuff. But I know from, you know, the family historians, we actually have one on my mom's side who's traced it way back to like the 15th century, I think. But, you know, if you go back, you can find African, Dutch, Portuguese, Spanish, Russian, which I didn't even know about till after my maternal grandmother passed away. And I saw her birth certificate, country of parents' birth, Russia. I didn't even know about that. So all those countries are in the mix.
I'm convinced, though, you got your voice from your grandfather, because I've always thought, you know, if Jay wasn't a sports writer, he could like host a late night jazz show like Miles Davis.
My grandfather didn't have the voice.
You just got that smooth. You got that smoothness.
Yeah, that's not from my mom's side of the family. Probably my father's. Okay. Yeah, he just played the violin. It's funny because we were talking about. So I was at an event today at Northwestern, and it's a scholarship luncheon with the benefactors and the scholarship recipients. And the president of the school, Morton Shapiro, was talking about studies that have been done that show how the trajectory can change for the people in the bottom 20% economically in America. So typically, if you're in the bottom 20% of the economic levels, you only have an 8% chance of making it to the top 20%. But as you go to high-level public schools and then the elite private colleges, you can get up to a 40 or 50% chance of making it up into the upper 20%. We really try to emphasize trying to give people first-generation college students, first-time college students, Pell Grant recipients an opportunity to go to a school, an opportunity to get on that path. And kind of my path, you could say, began way back with my grandfather when he wanted to go to Juilliard. And his father really didn't want to, but he made a deal with him. He said, okay, you know, we'll set up an audition, and if you can get in, then I'll pay for you to go. And he auditioned, and, you know, he wowed him, and he got in. And so that set him on that track and kind of set him on that career course and life course. And, you know, he met my grandmother while he was playing in a band or orchestra that played. He did these cruise ships for a while, and that's where he met my grandmother, was playing on one of the cruise ships. So, like, you know, you think of these moments in your family history and him passing that audition and getting into Juilliard, you know, led to everything sitting in my apartment looking out over Lake Michigan.
You know, it's such a great story. Like the fork in the roads in life and the sort of what I would call the tectonic plates, how they sort of shift a little bit. And you go a completely different direction, and the landscape goes a completely, and that happened with your dad. I mean, we're just in DC this week with all this news about if you live in Southeast, you're liable to live 21 years less than somebody in Woodley Park area, which, you know, is by the zoo and mostly old white people. And it's just like
21 years,
and 21 like, what, years. Like, and it was just sad.
How far apart is, like, 4 or 5 miles apart, right? Like
7 miles, 7 miles, 7 miles, right? Wow. 7 miles. And it's just so wrong on so many levels. And I, you know, it's like, you know, poor black communities don't need to be told this, but it just bothered me so much that it's like, it's not a black problem. It's a freaking societal problem. We need to fix that. And that you could, we talk about, like, how many people in this world would give for 21 more years on Earth? Shoot, I give 21.2 was the number. I give my left arm for 0.2, you know. So it just bothered me on so many levels. But I love those fork in the roads. All right, a couple quick ones. Greatest interview that Jay Adondi has ever had with a professional athlete.
These get harder.
Or somebody in the sports world.
Magic is great. Magic was always great. Elton Brand, really good. Brandon Roy. I'll say Grant Hill.
Grant Hill. That's fair. I would put him in my top five.
Two columns where he just totally – I just turned the column over to him. He was so good. I just basically, like, and started wanting paragraph after paragraph of him. So very few people have done that. So I'm going to say Grant Hill.
All right. 1986 Celtics, 2017 Golden State Warriors. Maybe two, when did they go 16-1? Last year? No, the year before.
2 years ago.
Yeah, 2017
right?
Golden. Yeah, 2017 Golden State Warriors, 1996 Chicago Bulls. You had to pick one all-time great
three?
Team. Yep.
Bulls. Just can't go against Michael
come
Jordan.
Come on.
I can't go against Michael Jordan.
I know you.
125 out of his last 26 playoff series. Who's beating Michael Jordan? Who's beating prime Michael Jordan in the 90s?
In the 90s? With those rules? Probably nobody. You're right. All right. Most less than obvious angle story that you've ever written where like you took something that you thought was just small and insignificant and it turned into a story about life and something bigger than you ever imagined.
One of my favorites was Ray Allen and the Celtics and Outliers, the Malcolm Gladwell book. So I saw him reading it in the locker room before a game and in LA. And I asked him about
Ray
it.
Ray Allen was reading the Malcolm Gladwell. Ray Allen was reading the Malcolm Gladwell book.
And we talked about it a little bit. I said, you know what? I'm going to read it. And next time you're out here, we'll have a discussion about it. And she said, okay. So I got the book, read it. And I had a conversation with Ray about it. And I just thought it turned into an interesting column. It was just something different, you know? And so looking at how the concepts and Outliers could explain the success of the Boston Celtics, that Celtics team, you know, that big three, Ray Allen, Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce group, you know, and how some of the concepts from Outliers apply to that. And I like doing stories like that. And that one was pretty fun just because it was different.
And last one, your favorite colleague over the years, not named Mike Wise.
I got to go with Wilbon. He's been such a great friend and mentor.
I knew you were going to say Wilbon, and that's a good choice.
You know, he shared so much with me, you know, opened my eyes to so much, you know, had me in his home so many times. No one has given me anything close to as much as Mike Wilbon has given me personally and professionally. So that's an easy call. As many great people as I've been fortunate to work with, you know, he really stands out.
Yeah, but he's one of the only guys I know, Jay, that is, I guess, that successful, and people don't root against him to fail. Like I could tell you 50 people that want Kornheiser to crash and burn. I could tell you 100,000 people that want Lubica to crash and burn. He kind of has already, so people are happy. And I could tell you like, well, I, you know, me, I'm congenial. I get along with everybody. I actually, you know, if Peter Vesey fell off the earth and he had one hand and I had to grab him, I might not grab him. But he's the only person.
He put a hit out on you in his column. I still remember that. I remember him putting a hit on you in his column. That was like in the great New York newspaper battles. Yeah, he put a hit out on you.
And I was half honored and I was half sad because I always liked Peter Vesey and thought, you know, like, oh, he talked to me. And then all of a sudden it's like, he's using Biggie lyrics saying, if he got to go, I got to go. And I'm like, oh, jeez.
You know, you guys had different opinions about the direction of the Knicks, right? And who should be calling the shots.
Right.
Like,
oh, no. It was over, great. Right? Yeah, no. Yeah, no, it was one of the great sort of media wars. Oh,
it was you.
All right, so
and Messi and was it Isola? Who's like the third?
Well, sort of like Isola and me and
it was like a triangle.
Yeah, I think maybe O'Connor were like invested in Jeff because, you know, he was the kind of the mailroom guy that got promoted to CEO. We wanted to see him do well. And we knew that everybody was trying to screw him behind the scenes. And Vesey was Ernie Grunfeld's guy at the time. Right. And it's funny now because Ernie and I call Ernie once a week to see if he's okay after he lost his job. I'm so pathetic. But I, you know, like I like Ernie now and we become, but at the time, Ernie was sort of, Vesey was Ernie's guy because that, you know, Ernie came up with that. Vesey was the NBA columnist for the Post at the time that Ernie was playing for the Knicks, and he became one of his sources, I'm sure, later. And and sort of the guys that, you know, drove to their mansions in New Canaan, Lupica and others were in Checkets people because,
Checkets, yeah.
because Dave Checkets at the time was living in New Canaan next to Mike Lupica, and they shared, they probably shared Martha Stewart recipes. I have no idea. So, it was a funny time.
It was great.
It was entertaining. Hey, this has been fun. I really appreciate the time, and this podcast world is different for me, but you made it more than enjoyable. So thank you.
It's great to see you taking advantage of the new media, and you know, best of luck to you and everyone at Pure Hoops.
All right, let's go. Time to stick the landing.
Episode 19 in the books. Can you believe they've kept me this long? Thank you, Jay Adande. You join a great list of media guests, including Rick Bucher, Howard Beck, Frank Isola, Jason Whitlock. On the list goes. Thanks, Bruce Bernstein, for putting this together as usual. Pure Hoops Media couldn't have done it without you, and especially to all my listeners. Download, rate, enjoy us. Shoot, listen to all the other shows at Pure Hoops Media. I guarantee you won't be disappointed, and I appreciate you. I really do. See you next week.
The Mike Wise Show used to be called The Wise Ass Show, but it remains a presentation of Pure Hoops Media.